What happens to a family when one of its members is accused of an unspeakable act?
The whole subject of sexuality, period, is unspeakable in this family, let alone the sort of really deviant sexuality we're talking about, the possibility that, Art, the priest, could have done this to a child. So it's a family that is completely paralyzed by this.
That's Jennifer Haig. We talked to her about her terrific new novel, Faith. Then
we find people who are more self-compassionate, are much less depressed, much less anxious, much happier, more optimistic.
We talked to Dr. Kristen Neff about her book, Self-Compassion, Stop Beating Yourself Up and Leave Insecurity Behind. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Jennifer Haig writes novels about families and their dynamics as they confront crises. We've spoken to her about her previous novels, Baker Towers and The Condition. Her new novel, Faith, centers around an accusation of sexual abuse on the part of a priest. I personally think it's her best so far. The novel is set in the Boston area in the year 2002, a year when, across the city's archdiocese, priests were accused of pedophilia. That's what happened to one of the characters in the novel, Art, the popular dynamic pastor of a large suburban parish. His sister Sheila can't believe he's guilty. His half-brother can. Their mother is unable to cope with the scandal that's embroiling her favorite son. And Art refuses to tell anyone his side of the story. Sheila sets out to solve the mystery of what has happened. And therein lies Jennifer Haig's tale. Jennifer Haig, welcome to Writer's Voice. Welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This book, Faith, the novel centers around an accusation, actually, of sexual abuse by a priest. This is an ongoing scandal in the Catholic Church. There have even been some recent headlines. Why did you choose this framework for this story?
Well, I moved to Boston in 2002, just as the clergy sex abuse scandal was exploding in the newspapers, and I found out about it the way everybody else found out about it, through the Boston Globe, which did a marvelous job of reporting this story. It hit very close to home for me because I was raised Catholic. I went to 12 years of parochial school. My family's quite devout, and I was completely blindsided by this. Nuns and priests were kind of integral to my childhood, and they were some of the most generous and inspiring people I knew. It was very hard for me to square these headlines with my own very tender memories of Catholic clergy. And like a lot of writers, I write about the things that disturb me. I write to make sense of the world. And there was no other way for me to parse this except to write about it.
So, yeah, to understand your world here, now, you focus in, you take the lens of a particular family, a family that may be not so unusual in some ways. There's the eldest son is a priest, but the story is told almost, not entirely, but mostly through the point of view of the sole daughter, Sheila McGann. Tell us about her.
Sheila is the middle child in this family. She has the closest relationship with her priest brother, Art. And the story opens when Art is accused of misconduct with an 8-year-old boy in his parish. Sheila is utterly shocked by this. Her impulse is to come back to Boston. She's since moved to Philadelphia, but she comes back to her family in Boston to try to get to the bottom of this and to be a support to her brother.
And then this happens. She comes back to be a support to her brother. She decides, in fact, that he's innocent. Her other brother doesn't quite have the same reaction.
Sheila's younger brother, Mike, is a father. He has three sons who are right around the age of the boy Art was supposedly molesting. And so he has an entirely different reaction from Sheila's. He feels very protective toward this child. He's also an ex-cop, and he still has a sort of a police instinct about this. So he also wants to get to the bottom of the story, but unlike Sheila, he presumes Art is guilty.
And then there's Mom. You know, I found it interesting. The novel opens up at a time much earlier when Sheila and Mike's and Art's mother In fact, she's recently given birth to Art. She's a young married woman. She seems to be kind of a woman with some real gaiety, with some real life, fun-loving. And then when we next meet her, she's a much more rigid, fearful personality. What happened to her?
Life happened to her. She's a person who's had some serious losses. Her first husband, Art's father, disappears. He abandons her, and it's the great heartbreak of her life, really. As a result of that abandonment, a lot of other things happen too. So we meet her again many years later. She's in her late 60s. We see what happened to that girl 50 years on.
And the relationship between the characters, between the siblings, sides are taken, not just around Art, but even there's a fissure that runs through this family.
Sure. They're a family of open secrets, really. There's a lot that is not talked about. I think that's not unusual in Catholic families. There is a sense of protocol, and there's a sense of privacy and discomfort around certain subjects. So the whole subject of sexuality, period, is unspeakable in this family, let alone the sort of really deviant sexuality we're talking about, the possibility that Art, the priest, could have done this to a child. So it's a family that is completely paralyzed by this.
Accusations of sexual abuse have been used, have been real, but they've also been used to manipulate. They've been used to create hysteria, whether wittingly or unwittingly. This is part of the atmosphere of this book.
Yeah, it's very much has to do with that particular moment in Boston. I chose 2002 for a reason. That's when the story opens, at the height of the scandal. It was the reaction of the Boston Archdiocese to any accusation at that time was hypervigilance and extraordinary concern about appearances. So that when Art is accused of molesting this child, they go into defense mode, and he's immediately, stripped of his duties. He's suspended. He's told to leave the rectory. A substitute is put in his place. He's basically rented an apartment and told to sit and wait till it shakes out. As we all know, 10 or 20 years earlier, the reaction would have been entirely different. Part of the scandal was that for many years, the hierarchy within the Boston Archdiocese had been aware that these bad priests were out there. They were not relieved of their duties. They were simply reassigned to other parishes, and where they did the same thing. So there was a long history of covering over these episodes. After 2002, that was no longer possible, and the Archdiocese had an immediate reaction to any accusation, and that's what happens to Art.
So in doing the research for this book, did you go through any kind of changes in your attitude? I mean, the sense that I have is, you must have first confronted this very much from the outside. And then as you did the research for this, you got deeper and deeper into some of these questions on how to handle these issues. Who is innocent? Who is guilty? How can we know? That seems to be very much at the center of this book. Did you go through any kind of transformations in your own attitudes to your own sense of how does one find the truth?
Sure. I have to say, though, that research was a very small part of writing this book. It's not research intensive, and it wasn't the process of researching that led me to those discoveries. I worked on this book in the way I always work on a novel, from the outside, and I imagine my way into the characters. And so I start out with a situation and kind of a rough outline of who these people are. And it's by living with them for 2 or 3 years that I really tunnel inside them. I ask myself a lot of questions about where they came from, how they came to be the people they are. It's the same process with every novel for me. So at the beginning, I'm writing about strangers. By the end of 2 or 3 years of writing, I'm writing about people I know extraordinarily well. They're as real to me as anybody in my own life. It doesn't start out that way. It's the process of writing and imagining that makes them real and complete and leads me to ask the questions that you're referencing.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because my experience of Art is that he is a very shadowy figure for a long, long period in the book. He only emerges very, very slowly. Is that the process that happened for you?
Yeah, I think that does mirror the process that happens for me. Part of the reason art is such a mysterious figure at the beginning is that the constraints of a priest's life sort of make it so. You know, it's a very isolated life. He's not a Benedictine or a Jesuit. He's not part of a religious community. He's a parish priest, a diocesan priest. It's a very important distinction because he never lives in community with other people. He lives as an island in a certain way. He lives alone in a house. His closest human contact is the housekeeper who prepares his meals. And that's it. That's what he's got. So a priest who lives in community has an entirely different emotional life than someone who lives in such isolation.
Yeah. 2002 is almost also is a transition in the whole position of the Catholic Church within the Catholic community in Boston, as I'm sure in many other places. I mean, a time when, you know, the church was becoming less and less attended. No longer is it the ideal for the eldest son to become a priest. Do you think that the sex scandals had anything to do with the, you know, I can't say demise, but the slow constriction of the Catholic Church in this country?
Yes, I think it certainly has played a role. I do think the church was losing prominence in people's lives long before this scandal exploded. There has been a steady decline in church attendance. That accelerated after this story broke in the early 2000s for reasons direct and indirect. The direct reasons are obvious, the sort of betrayal that many Catholics feel. You know, it's the worst sort of transgression imaginable, you know, from a person who is in this position of trust. So there's that, of course. In a less direct way, the church has spent so much money settling these lawsuits out of court that it has bankrupted many Catholic dioceses. For this reason, churches are closing. These communities of people people who were in their 60s or 70s who were baptized and raised in a particular parish, who made First Communion there and confirmation and were married there and buried their parents there, and they're losing that church. They're directed to some other Catholic church. They're separated from their community. This is a direct result of the sex scandals. The reason the diocese can't afford to keep some churches open is that the money is going elsewhere.
As someone who was raised Catholic, what's your sense about this? What's your feeling? Do you feel a kind of sadness at traditions that are going away?
I do. I have a great regard for Catholics. Some of the most good-hearted people I know, and I think it's been devastating.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon. If you just joined Writer's Voice, I'm talking with novelist Jennifer Haig about her newest book, Faith. It's about what happens to one Boston Irish family when the eldest son, a priest, is accused of molesting a young boy. Do you think that the meaning of religion, well, I mean, your novel is called Faith, so I have a sense that there are many layers in the meaning of that title. I wonder if you could talk about some of those meanings for you.
Sure. In the most literal way, it's a novel about religious faith. The central character is a Catholic priest. Most of the characters are believers, not all of them, but most of them. So there's that. But it also refers to the faith we have in each other, you know, the beliefs we hold about ourselves and the people closest to us. And for the main characters, all those are called into question. They're all in a period of questioning.
I've read now three of your novels, and I have to say, I think this one is my favorite. I loved it. I think you have always really explored, as novelists do, they explore the interior life of the individual. But this one, I think, reached to a level of integrity, of honesty, and of depth that, you know, went beyond even from your other books. How do you feel about this book? And do you sense a change in yourself as a novelist as you see this book, as you look at it?
This book has been a departure for me. The big discovery for me was the potential of writing in the first person. I'd never done that before in a novel. I'd done lots of short stories with first-person narration, and I like doing it. It always seemed to me a very limiting way to approach a novel because, think about it, it's rare that any one character knows all the good parts of any story. So it seemed to me that what I've done in the past, the more traditional, you know, close third person, is more flexible. But I will say that writing a novel in the first person opened me up in a different way. It almost felt like writing in a new language. I suppose it's similar to writing formal poetry. When you write sonnets, you have lots of rules to follow. You have lots of limitations. And that's where the art lies, working within those limitations, exploring the possibilities of that particular parameter. And writing a novel in the first person is very similar. That's where the art is, playing with what the narrator knows, what she does not know, what she believes, what she suspects, what she imagines, what she projects. There's a lot of that in Faith, because Sheila, the narrator, doesn't know the whole story. I chose this first-person narration for a specific reason. You know, when I've taught creative writing, I always tell my students, never do this. Never write in first person. It's too hard. There are too many ways to screw it up. I think you need a good reason to do it. And the reason for writing Faith in the first person is this. As I was reading many, many accounts of priests accused of misconduct with children, it struck me how difficult it is ever to get to the bottom of the story. There are never any witnesses. There's never any evidence. It's always one person's word against another. Sometimes it's nobody's word because nobody's talking about it. So for the rest of us who are trying to make sense of this, it's extremely difficult to penetrate to the truth of the story. That is precisely Sheila's experience in telling the story of her brother. She wasn't there when it happened. It all happened behind closed doors. So she goes through the same process that we all go through when we read these stories in the news, of trying to imagine what a particular person did or said and why, the motivations behind it. So this first-person narration was the perfect way to tell this story. I think it's the only way.
What were some of the challenges of it for you, though? Were there places where you bumped up against its limits and you had to then go do something else? For example, I think that, you know, especially as the story unfolds, we do begin to see things outside of Sheila's ken. We do shift to a third person. When we see the brother, and there's sections where finally we do see art. Oh, that's right. Actually, it is Sheila. Explain this to us, because actually for me it was seamless. I had to remind myself that this was Sheila again.
It's very interesting. Sheila's the sort of first-person narrator who moves in close to the story and then pulls way back. She's not telling her own story. She's talking about things that happened to somebody else. And so there are times when you're very aware that it's her voice recounting the story. There are times when her voice really recedes, and she's just telling what she knows, telling what she saw, telling what she heard. And you sort of forget that it's coming through Sheila. But in fact, it all is. It's all her version of events. There's a passage very early in the book where she's talking about the Gospels. Essentially four different versions of what is at heart the same story, the life of Christ. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John focus on different parts of the story. Matthew is very interested in Jesus' childhood and writes at great length about his early years. Mark is very terse. He focuses on the end game, the betrayal, the crucifixion, and the death. Luke is a hearsay sort of narrator. He lived 100 years after Christ. He wasn't around for any of this. It's all just what he's been told. And John, of course, writes the miracles. And Sheila compares this to the way the stories of her own family are told, that the same story is told quite differently by her mother, by Art, by Mike, by her Aunt Claire. Everybody's got their own version of events. And Sheila tells you straight up, okay, this is my version of events. This is my gospel. Some of it will be similar to what my mother would say or how my brother would describe it, but some of it won't be. It's her version.
That's fascinating, because you're absolutely right. I mean, I really did have to remind myself that this was Sheila's story. You know, what you're describing is the kind of the Rashomon, phenomenon, and how everything sees things through their own way. Sheila is changed, though, I think, in the course of this. So the narrative that she would have had in the beginning is different than the narrative she develops, because she is the historian, basically, here.
Yes, Sheila's perspective changes as she discovers more of the story. At the beginning, she's has a knee-jerk reaction, of course my brother is innocent, none of this can be true. She sets out to prove that. And as she learns more, she starts to question whether in fact he might have done this thing. And she has a real crisis of faith in her brother. Her beliefs about him are called into question. And as the story progresses, she wavers back and forth. You know, she learns things that sway her to one side or the other. By the end, she comes to a conclusion, but it's by no means a linear process.
Is this perspective uniquely the first person, do you feel, was something that you had to use for this story? I mean, could it have worked in another way?
Yes, it could have. It would have been a very different book. And when I started out writing, I approached it the way I've approached novels in the past, because I know how to do that. It's familiar to me. I could have done the story this way. I could have told part of it from Sheila's perspective. I could have gotten inside Mike's head and Art's head. And that could have been done. It would have been a different book, a more traditional book, maybe. One thing this first-person narrator allows me to do is create a kind of suspense. If I were inside Art's point of view, you'd get the straight story from the beginning. There would be no sort of discovery. But because we don't have access to his thoughts, you know, the reader is figuring it out along with Sheila. It's a mystery. It really, I believe that all successful novels in the end are mystery stories. I don't read thrillers. I don't read crime novels. I don't see those kinds of movies. I have no interest in writing that sort of thing. You don't have to have a dead body for it to be a mystery. And I think that as readers, we're simple creatures. We all read for exactly the same reason, to see what happens next. And if the reader doesn't feel that urgency, that curiosity, the novel fails, no matter how beautifully written it might be or how profound it might be. The thing we need to keep us going is that suspense. Working in first person allowed me to write this very suspenseful story.
And it was certainly that. We're talking with Jennifer Haig about her new novel, Faith, and I highly recommend it to all our listeners. Another thing that many books do, although not the best ones, is they take sides. And I really felt that you, as a novelist, didn't take a side in this story. Could you talk a little bit about that? How was that process for you?
Well, I think it's a sure recipe to write a very bad work of fiction if you go into it with an agenda, with an ideology you're trying to promote. For me, writing a novel always is an exercise in compassion. It's an exercise in empathy. And the whole point of it is for me as a writer to understand from the inside these characters and to make the reader understand them. I don't pass judgment on my characters. I've never written a villain. I've never written a hero. To me, they're all flawed people with some virtues and some glaring weaknesses. And that's been true of every character I've ever written.
You've mentioned that you write a novel about every 3 years. What is it about this three-year cycle that seems to be the one that's right for you in bringing a book to fruition?
There seems to be a natural cycle that I go through. It's the same every time, really. When I finish writing a book, I'm always sure I'll never write another word. I feel that every thought I've ever had is in that book. And how could I possibly feel that strongly about another set of characters? How could I possibly have that level of commitment to another story? It seems impossible, and I think, well, maybe it's time for me to go to beauty school and learn to do hair. I really need to find another line of work. And it takes several months for the dust to settle and for something else to emerge, at least 6 months, sometimes longer. So I'm not even working the whole 3 years. The first 6 months are a frustrating and kind of discouraging time, and I'm casting around and considering ideas and rejecting them. And, you know, maybe I'll work on a short story or something, but I don't have that sense of purpose I have when I'm working on a novel. It leaves a huge hole in my life when I finish a book. I hate finishing.
You hate finishing? So how do you know when you are finished?
Oh, you just know. It's like asking, how do you know when you're in love? You know.
Well, I don't know. I've had the opposite experience of not knowing when I'm finished. The temptation to revise endlessly. But you don't have that.
Oh, not true. I adore revision. It's the only part I actually like. The first draft to me is pure pain. It's anxiety producing, to say the least. I always have a great fear that I'm not going to figure out the proper ending for this story. And look, we've all had this experience as readers. You discover a book, the first chapter's brilliant, you're hooked, you can't put it down. The ending is so disappointing that you want to throw the thing across the room. You don't remember it as the novel with the great opening chapter. You remember it as the book with the lousy ending. And I'm always living in fear of writing that book with a lousy ending. So until I get through an entire first draft, I have no confidence I'm going to know how to land the plane. Once I've gotten to the end of the first draft, which takes a year or a year and a half, then I relax a little bit. I can start revising. The second draft, the third draft, the fourth draft. To me, that's where the joy lies, where you see the work become good. My favorite part is the final 6 months where I'm just punctuating. I'm putting in commas and taking them back out again. When I reach the point where I'm putting in the same commas and taking them same ones out day after day, then I know I'm done.
That's a wonderful tip. I have to say, you hit it out of the park with this one. The ending was completely surprising and absolutely perfect. It really was. It just was so right. What I'm getting here is that you don't really have a clue of what your next book is going to be until you're really put the other one away.
It's true. I'm very monogamous in my writing habits. I can't even look at another novel when I'm in love with one. And that's why I have this long lag time in between. At the moment, I do know what I'm working on next simply because it's a collection of short stories I've been writing for 8 years. They've been slow in coming because I'll write a story maybe after I finish a first draft of a novel. I need to put that draft down for a month, go do something else. I'll work on a story. In between books, I love to write short stories. They were my first love, and I do go back to them when I have a break in a novel. So at the moment, I'm very close to having a complete collection. I have 9 stories finished, 1 more to go. That will be my mission over the summer, to finish that last story. It's a collection that will be interesting to people who know my work, because they're all set in or around the town of Bakerton, which is the little coal mining town in western Pennsylvania where Baker Towers is set. In fact, there are a couple characters from Baker Towers who reappear in this collection of stories. The question I always get about Baker Towers is, whatever happened to Sandy Novak, the glamorous, handsome younger brother who runs off to California and is never seen again? Well, in the story collection, you will find out what happened to Sandy Novak. So a lot of those questions I get from readers of Baker Towers will be addressed in this next book. I'm hoping to finish it this summer, possibly publish it next spring.
Oh, wonderful. We look forward to that. Well, thank you so much, Jennifer Haig. I loved this book, and I look forward to the next one.
Thank you, Francesca.
Jennifer Haig is the author of the New York Times bestsellers The Condition, Baker Towers, winner of the 2006 Penn LL Winship Award, and Mrs. Kimball, which won the Penn Hemingway Award. Haig's short stories have appeared in The Atlantic, Granta, The Saturday Evening Post, and many other publications. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from her newest novel, Faith. Next up, we explore how being more self-compassionate can help you break bad habits, be less stressed, and even lose weight. Stay tuned after the break.
Gonna lay my burden. Lay my body in the ground, corn clay against my skin, but I don't care at all. Can't seem to find my peace of mind, so with the earth I'll lay entwined. 6 feet to the other side, I'll put your picture way up high, but I'm not coming back to you, it's just too far.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. With record levels of self-esteem, why are we Americans so darn hard on ourselves? We're stressed and depressed, going droves to plastic surgeons, and all want to be like the kids in Lake Wobegon, above average. Is it making us happier? I don't think so. My guest, human development expert Dr. Kristen Neff, thinks self-esteem has been oversold. She borrows from the Buddhist concept of compassion to counsel self-compassion as a better and more effective path to happiness. And the funny thing is, it seems to work. Scientific studies show that dieters who practice self-compassion lose more weight and keep it off longer than those who beat themselves up for their cravings and backsliding. Kristen Neff is an associate professor in human development and culture at the University of Texas at Austin. She's been researching self-compassion since 1997 and has developed an 8-week program called Mindful Self-Compassion to help people learn the skill. Her book is Self-Compassion, Stop Beating Yourself Up and Leave Insecurity Behind. Dr. Kristen Neff, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you know, I read about your book in a New York Times article that said that people are able to lose weight more easily if they are compassionate with themselves instead of being self-critical.
Yeah, it's, there was one study on that. There's also been studies of stopping smoking, exercise programs. Most people really, I think, make the mistake of thinking that self-criticism is an effective motivator, but actually it turns out that self-compassion is a much more effective motivator.
And, well, I guess this would be a good time to tell us, kind of define, what is self-compassion? It sounds very Buddhist.
Well, just because it is. It's funny, some people are saying, Kristen Neff, you know, came up with the idea of self-compassion, and of course it's a 2,500-year-old idea. I was just one of the first people to write about it in academia, but it does come from Buddhism. In Buddhist thought, compassion is emphasized strongly, but there's also not a strong difference made between self and other. We're all interdependent. We're all part of the same existence. So the idea is you need to be compassionate to yourself and others, that you shouldn't really make a distinction. And when I started practicing Buddhism that I discovered self-compassion. And I was going through a really difficult time in my life, going through a messy divorce, and it really just saved my life. So I discovered it firsthand as I began practicing Buddhist meditation. And then so when I got my first job at UT Austin, I said I want to make this my life's work and study it. And I still didn't answer your question. So what is self-compassion? It's basically treating yourself with the same type of kind, compassionate, caring concern that you would a good friend or anyone else you cared about. Noticing when you're suffering, not being harshly judgmental, being kind, understandive, and supportive. Framing the experience of imperfection as part of a shared human experience, and really just being there for yourself when you need it most, giving yourself emotional support.
You know, you write in your book that people have kind of an initial reaction against this, like, oh, if I do this, you know, somehow I'm selfish, or I'm not a good person, or I won't do what I have to.
Yes. It's funny, in my research, I've asked people over and over again, you know, why aren't you more self-compassionate? What do you think about this idea? And everyone says, I think if I give up my self-criticism, I'll let myself get away with anything. I'll just become self-indulgent. They really think their self-criticism is necessary to motivate themselves. But of course, if you think about, let's say, a mother motivating her child, if her child came home with a bad exam grade and she said, you're so stupid and worthless, you'll never amount to anything, you know, which is what we say to ourselves, that's going to depress the child, not make them motivated at all, and probably want the child decide to take up basketball instead of math. And the same is with ourselves. Our research shows that when we're very self-critical, we lose faith in ourselves, and we start to fear failure. It's just too scary to try, because if we fail, we're going to, you know, bash ourselves over the head with self-criticism. Whereas people who can trust that, hey, it's okay to try and it's okay to fail, I'm going to go for it. You know, I believe in myself. They actually end up doing much better.
You said in your book that people actually become self-critical adults often as a pattern of defense against the criticism they experienced from parents as a child.
Yeah, sadly. I mean, and there's lots of ways to have low self-compassion, but that's a fairly common one. If your parents are very critical of you, well, first of all, you're going to internalize their voice. It's going to just end up being inside your own head. But also the idea is if you know mom or dad's going to be cutting you down the second you make a mistake, children start criticizing themselves first to try to catch themselves so they can kind of, you know, prevent their parents' criticism by doing the job themselves first. And for a child, you know, it's somewhat effective. It's a coping mechanism and it works, but it leaves some real scars in the psyche. And depression and anxiety are two of the worst scars of that.
You get very personal in this book. You talk about your own experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really doesn't sound like you grew up in such a terribly, extremely critical environment, and yet your relationship with your father was problematic, and that had some effect in how critical, kind of the relationships you had with men.
Right, yeah. So I was lucky my mother wasn't very critical. She was very supportive, which made a huge difference. My father wasn't critical, he just wasn't around. So I think I just really developed the belief early on that I wasn't worthy of male attention. And that's another way in which I didn't have compassion for myself. I didn't feel I was worthy of, you know, male love and support. And that's something that actually eventually self-compassion helped me have.
I found it interesting that with all this kind of self-criticism that's going around, the people in general think that they're better, they're more superior than the average. Talk about that and also tell us that that's true everywhere, even in the so-called more modest cultures like the Asian cultures.
Right. It's kind of hard to make sense of because the findings are very conflicting, and I think that's because we're very conflicted. So at the same time that Americans really criticize themselves, are at huge rates of depression, which is directly linked to self-criticism, we also have the highest levels of narcissism ever recorded, highest levels of self-esteem ever recorded. So it's like we have this really unstable relationship to ourselves. We have to feel special and above average to be okay, which means I have to be better than you to kind of feel okay about myself. At the same time, my standards for myself are so high that the second I fall short of my ideals, which is constantly, then I criticize myself. So, you know, it seems like both are human tendencies, the tendency to criticize yourself and the tendency to want to be special and above average. Now, it's interesting in cultures like Japan. I mean, there are cultural differences, definitely. The self-esteem levels aren't as high. It's not as emphasized in the culture. They aren't given gold stars by the time they're, you know, two onward. On the other hand, people still want to feel good about themselves within their cultural norms. So this research showing that most Japanese think they're more humble than their peers. They're more self-effacing than their peers. They're more modest than their peers. So it's like however the ego can slip itself in there to feel good about itself, even if it feels good about itself by feeling bad about itself, which seems crazy, but that's kind of what's happening. You know, it'll find a way to assert itself.
But you say there's also kind of an evolutionary reason behind this.
Yeah, right. So actually, you know, one of the reasons we have both systems strongly is that they're all physiologically based, all right? So luckily, for people who have a hard time being self-compassionate, compassion has a physiological basis. All mammals, in fact, have this caregiving system which allows both the mother to give care and support to the infant and the infant to receive it from the mother. And we have, you know, oxytocin, opiates released. So when we're giving ourselves compassion, we're actually tapping into that physiological system, changing our biochemistry. Criticism comes from the threat defense system, right? Attack or submit. And of course, if you think about it, with self-criticism, we're both the attacker and the one submitting to the attack. And that releases cortisol and stress and activates that system. And then self-esteem is actually part of the social hierarchy system. You know, most animals have a hierarchy system, who's on top, who's on bottom. And that's associated with its own set of biochemicals. So these are all aspects of being human. We shouldn't judge ourselves for having them. It's just that we tend to underuse the compassion system and overuse the social ranking and the threat defense system.
The book is Self-Compassion, Stop Beating Yourself Up and Leave Insecurity Behind. We're talking with the author, Dr. Kristen Neff. She teaches at the University of Texas in Austin, where she also conducts research on self-compassion. So what is the difference between self-esteem and self-compassion?
Right. Well, you know, in some ways they overlap in that they both are a way to feel positive emotions towards ourselves. But they do kind of go together. People who are compassionate to themselves have a higher sense of self-worth than those who cut themselves down constantly. But they really come from a very different source. So self-esteem, there's a lot of ways to get it, but usually in our culture you get it, again, by being special and above average. I have to be better than you to feel okay about myself. I also have to excel in the areas that are really important to me. It's not okay to not meet my goals. Let's say if I want to be a certain, weight or reach a certain stage in my career. Self-esteem also is contingent, meaning that, you know, I have it when things are going well, when I succeed, and I lose it when things aren't going well and I fail. So self-esteem can actually be very unstable. So self-esteem is about feeling good about yourself when you act when you are as good as you want to be. So self-compassion in some ways is the exact opposite. Self-compassion comes in precisely where self-esteem falls down, when you fail and mess up or notice a way in which you're imperfect. So self-compassion is not about being above average, it's about being human. It's about remembering, wait, whoever said the human experience was about being perfect? You know, where's that contract I signed that said I would be perfect, that life would be perfect? This is normal. You know, we all share this. Can I feel connected to my fellow human beings in the fact that, you know, I failed and I made a mistake and I'll get up and try again, but it's okay. I don't need to be better than other people to be worthy. I am worthy just because I'm a human being who's struggling like everyone else.
What do you think of the studies that have shown that the self-esteem movement in the schools hasn't really been all that great for children?
Actually, I don't know if you've read Jean Twenge's book, Generation Me, who talks about the self-esteem movement in the school, which she blames that for the generation of narcissists we have, but that it, you know, it stops people from trying. But yeah, there's a lot of problems with the self-esteem movement. Here's the thing. With self-esteem, you have to achieve something to get it. It's not intrinsic. I've got to succeed. I've got to be perfect. I have to meet my goals. So if you give people self-esteem without having to meet their goals, then they kind of just become narcissists. On the other hand, if they feel bad about themselves, then they're depressed and anxious. So we need a way to feel good about ourselves and motivate ourselves, but that isn't about being superior. And that's why I'm so drawn to self-compassion, because you motivate yourself because you care, not because you aren't good enough, but because you care about yourself and want to be happy. And you feel good about yourself because you're a human being. So it really, I argue, and the research is actually really supporting this, that self-compassion offers the mental health benefits of self-esteem, but without the drawbacks.
So talk about the research that you've done.
All right. So when I started my research, I made a scale to measure self-compassion. Not that I knew anything about making scales, but I thought I had to start somewhere. So it turned out pretty well. So if you just look at naturally occurring variation in self-compassion, people who are high or low on the scale, we find people who are more self-compassionate are much less depressed, much less anxious, much happier, more optimistic. They tend to approach new challenges wanting just to learn and grow as opposed to necessarily impress other people. Their sense of self-worth is much more stable. They're really satisfied with their lives. They don't tend to put other people down as much. So really on and on, the more studies we do, the more we realize how strongly this is associated with mental health. What I find is really exciting, and I'm not doing this work, I'm not capable of it, but people are now starting to look at the brainwave patterns associated with self-compassion, again, and the physiology. And they find that where self-compassion is registered in the brain is the same place compassion for others is registered. And it releases, again, oxytocin, opiates, all those kind of feel-good, calm-down hormones, whereas self-criticism is registered in a different part of the brain and releases all these stress hormones. So you really are tapping into different parts of the brain, two different physiological systems, when you choose to give yourself self-compassion instead of self-criticism. And there's a lot of benefits associated with the kind of calming, soothing, and not stressed-out system.
You say there are three core components to self-compassion.
Yes.
Let's delve down a little bit deeper into this phenomenon. What are they?
Okay. And by the way, when I came up with these, what I did was read any Buddhist book I could get my hands on that talked about self-compassion. So, you know, I came up with the model, but I was just trying to accurately represent what was in the more spiritual literature. So the most obvious component, which I think people can get in touch with, is being kind to yourself versus self-critical, being kind, supportive, caring, actively soothing yourself. And if you don't mind, I'd love to give listeners a little taste of this so it's not just so abstract.
Oh, please do.
Okay. So if you take both arms, put them straight out to your side like in a T, and you clench your fists really hard, that's what self-criticism feels like. And then you open up your fists, and that's what letting go of self-judgment feels like. And then you put your hands over your heart, and that's the kind of active, self-soothing aspect of self-kindness. So it's more than just not judging yourself. You do let that go, and that feels good, but you actively give yourself support. And like I said, that's related to certain physiological systems. So that's one, the most obvious element.
Oh, I have to say, I just did this as you said it. Wow.
Isn't it amazing?
It is amazing.
It's so simple, but your body feels it.
Yes. And I just took it, like, as soon as I put my hands over my heart, I took a deep breath, just naturally.
And the great thing about that is if you're really tense or really, upset about something, you can use your body. I tell people, give yourself a hug. If no one's looking, give yourself a hug. Your body registers it, even if your mind isn't ready to go there yet. It's actually quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's the self-kindness component. The other one, I didn't realize at first, but I realized in order to give yourself compassion for your suffering, you have to be aware of it. And that's the mindfulness piece. So a lot of us, we think we're aware of our suffering, but often we aren't. First of all, if our suffering comes from our own self-criticism, we are totally lost in the role of, the criticizer. We often don't realize how much pain we feel when we cause ourselves suffering through our own self-criticism. We're just kind of lost in the rant. Or what happens is we often go into problem-solving mode when something goes wrong. Your mother gets sick, and you get on the phone, and you arrange everything, and you don't stop to say, wow, this is really hard, I'm really struggling. So you have to be mindful of the fact that you're in pain and that you need comfort and care and compassion. But mindful meaning seeing things clearly, not like going off into a self-pity soap opera. That's not self-compassion either. Mm-hmm. Compassion is I acknowledge I'm in pain, and I respond appropriately, not in an exaggerated way. And then the third component is this common humanity component. What makes self-compassion different from self-pity? Well, self-pity is poor me. Self-compassion is this is the human condition. We're all in this boat together. You actually feel, with self-compassion, you feel connected to others in the experience of suffering. Often, though, ironically, when something goes wrong, it's not logical, but you feel like, this is not supposed to be this way. I'm not supposed to be imperfect. Life isn't supposed to be imperfect. If someone asked you, is it supposed to be this way, you'd say, yes, of course. But emotionally, irrationally, in that moment, you feel very cut off, separated, and isolated. In fact, they find that that sense of isolation associated with failure is one of the most emotionally damaging parts of it. So it's remembering, hey, this is part of the human experience. We all share it. Just kind of being with things as they are, not suppressing it, not exaggerating it, and responding with an open heart.
And then you can let it go.
Yes. I mean, here's I don't want to get too Buddhist on your listeners, but there's a huge, mindfulness movement, which you are probably aware of. The beauty of when you don't cling to something, but you don't try to push it away, right? You just let it be as it is. So in this case, with your suffering or your, sense of, oh, I messed up or I've got this problem, you just let it be and you hold it with a kind, open heart. So you aren't suppressing it, but you aren't trying to, do positive thinking and, make yourself convinced that the problem isn't there. The problem is there. And you just hold it with kindness. And then it tends to heal on its own. It's really quite remarkable.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Dr. Kristen Neff. Her book is Self-Compassion, Stop Beating Yourself Up and Leave Insecurity Behind. You know, it's so interesting as you talk here. I mean, I know you You have developed this out of your own study of Buddhism, and some of these concepts are familiar to me. I have, you know, I'm not a meditator, but I wish I were, and I have read a lot about it.
Yeah.
But what's so interesting is this intersection of spirituality and psychology. It just seems to make so much sense.
Yeah.
Well, talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly in part of this whole movement among scientists studying a lot of these concepts, and not just Buddhism, but any sort of contemplative tradition. There's a lot of this in Christianity as well. And the Dalai Lama holds retreats every year for scientists to delve into these things. But I think with psychology, it really is about your own phenomenological experience. You know, what do I observe happening right here and right now? And science is supposed to be about observing outside experience. So you really have to bring the two together, you know, observe from the inside and observe from the outside. And when you do that with no agenda and no set belief system and just say, let's, you know, meditation is like an experiment. Let me sit down, watch my mind and see what happens. And if I try this, see what happens. It's actually very scientific in its approach. So there seems to be this beautiful romance going on now between scientists and Buddhists and meditators, and you know, really remarkable research is coming out, especially now that we have the fMRI. It's just, you know, scoring high on my scale, people say, oh yeah, that's very nice. Showing the brain lit up in a certain area, they say, ooh, wow, that's something.
What lights up?
Well, the left prefrontal cortex tends to light up when you're dealing with compassion. Right,
and what does that mean?
Well, I mean, I have to admit, as someone who doesn't do brain research, I have to chuckle a little bit because I don't think it shows you that much more to show a picture, part of the brain lighting up than you score high on my scale. But they can localize it. It feels real when you look at it and you see how this part of the brain that's associated with empathy and that's associated with compassion and that's associated with, you know, feelings of care and closeness and connection. Then obviously somehow it's real because I can see it, and it lights up in a different place than when I criticize myself. I think people were a bit too in love with fMRI. Don't tell anyone I said that.
but it does show that there is something going on in the brain there.
Right. In other words, I think before a topic like compassion or even self-compassion, it'd be too easy to dismiss it as, oh yeah, that's very sweet, nice idea. You know, but why should we care? You know, why isn't this not just another Hallmark card? But if you can say, you know, look, we can see the physiology is changing. We can do studies, so it helps people stop smoking, helps people lose weight, helps people get less depressed. You know, I'm sure the studies are, there's like 3 grant proposals now for looking at self-compassion among vets with PTSD. I mean, this stuff works, and if it's going to make a splash in psychology, it will only do so if it works. So, you know, the proof is really in the pudding. It's not just a good idea. Mm-hmm. It worked for me in my real life, which is why I started studying it. That's what came first. But then the more and more research is done, the more it just seems to say, hey, this is something important.
I also recently read some research that showed that longevity is tied to the ability to bounce back from life's challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess what they call emotional resilience. Does self-compassion help to make us more emotionally resilient?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that self-compassion is emotional resilience. I mean, there's various ways we might be resilient in difficult times, but in some ways, having compassion for suffering is, I think in some ways, you could almost call that emotional resilience. And, you know, there's certainly, we've done some research looking at coping strategies, and people with more self-compassion do cope better. But I think it's just really a different way of naming what is it that allows people to bounce back from adversity. So giving yourself support, care, kindness, I'm not feeling so isolated, reaching out to other people, all those things are part of this overall package of really trying to respond in a proactive and yet proactive and yet accepting manner of what has happened. Mm. Right? If you fight things and you fight the reality that this has happened or I've got cancer or whatever, the fight itself causes you more suffering.
Much less telling yourself that you have cancer because of something you did.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that's terrible because that actually does happen, and it's just heartbreaking. You know, people, since starting this research, I I was fairly self-critical. My problems are a little bit different, but I had no idea how self-critical people are. It just breaks my heart. But some of the most beautiful, caring, loving, giving people, I met this a doctor on a retreat who, she just works with children with cancer. I mean, she's like Mother Teresa, and she tears herself to shreds. Just amazing how common it is. I just wish I could say, oh, please stop.
Well, you are saying that.
Yeah, I guess that's true. That's the title of my book. Okay, good. It's really remarkable how many people are so kind, compassionate, caring to others, and so hard on themselves. And in fact, the two aren't associated because there's so many people who are compassionate to others and not to themselves. You know, I expected that compassion for self and others would be correlated. Mm-hmm. They actually aren't. It's just that people with high levels of self-compassion are equally kind to themselves and others, and people with low levels of self-compassion are much kinder to others than themselves.
Wow. But they could still be each as kind to others.
They could still be each as kind to others.
Now, you have a website. And
yes.
Are there places there on your website where people can go and kind of test themselves or learn some of these things? I watched some of your videos, by the way, which I thought were very good on YouTube. And we will link to them when we air the show.
Yeah. Yeah, so on my website, you can test your own self-compassion level, and it gives you your overall score and also the components of self-compassion. I have exercises up there. I've guided meditations. There are some YouTube videos. I also have just about anything anyone's published on self-compassion up there on my website. So I've really tried to make it a resource, both for the general public and also for any, you know, students or people interested in the academic side of things. So I'm quite happy with it. I also have links to other websites that are related and connected.
And we link to Dr. Neff's website at writersvoice.net. You can take a test to find out how self-compassionate you are, learn exercises to increase self-compassion, and find guided self-compassion meditations. Finally, a brief book review in lieu of an interview. Novelist Siri Hustvedt gave me a wonderful interview at her home in Brooklyn, New York, about her terrific novel, The Summer Without Men. Alas, my digital recorder decided later that day to give up the ghost before I'd had a chance to copy the interview to a more secure location. A Summer Without Men is about a woman who spends a summer recuperating from a nervous breakdown she suffered when her husband of 30 years told her that he wanted to take a pause from their marriage to have an affair with a much younger colleague from work. His wife, Mia, goes back to her hometown to be near her elderly mother, who's in an assisted living facility. There, Mia develops friendships with a number of women. There's a young mother next door who has an emotionally abusive husband and is seeking to define herself. There's my favorite character, an elderly creative genius who lives in the same residence as Mia's mother. She pours her artistic passion into elaborate, sometimes erotic needlepoint designs that are a sharp commentary on the place of women in society. And then there are Mia's students, teenage girls taking a summer writing course who become embroiled in a bullying incident that Mia unravels. Throughout the summer, Mia moves from gingerly exploring what her marriage has meant to finding a deeper center within herself from which to face her husband and the world. Siri Hustvedt's book is simply one of the most enjoyable and thought-provoking novels I've read in a long time. This summer, The Summer Without Men makes for perfect summer reading. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.